Welcome to Talk Nation Radio, a half-hour discussion on politics, human rights, and the environment. I'm Dori Smith.
Hillary Clinton was very strongly challenged, and I think that her presence did not do anything to boost American popularity.
Our guest this time is Idris Ahmed. He grew up in Pakistan, and we're going to be discussing his recent visit to Pakistan, where he reported for Interpress Service. The title of his October 30th, 2009 story in Interpress, The U.S. in Pakistan's Mind, Nothing But Aversion. And you can find that at ipsnews.net. Idris Ahmed joins us from Glasgow, Scotland. He is a student at the University of Strathclyde working on his PhD. Idris Ahmed, welcome.
Thanks a lot. Pleasure to be with you.
You write about a shift in Pakistan, and I'm quoting, "The realization may be dawning slowly on some U.S. allies, but here everyone is convinced that Western forces have lost the war."
Well, what has been happening for some time is that inside Afghanistan, there is a realization that the military option alone isn't going to solve the problem. So for some time, initially it started with Karzai offering dialogue with the Taliban, and then many within the military started exploring that option that if there are, quote-unquote, more moderate factions within the Taliban, so they can somehow be weaned away from the larger group. And I think yesterday's, when this bill was being passed for the new funding for Afghanistan, so inside it also, it includes some appropriation for trying to buy off the so-called moderate elements. So they are trying to achieve what Petraeus had done in Iraq, so to buy off some elements and try to use them to subdue the rest.
What we saw in Iraq, too, was that the Coalition Provisional Authority was working with international corporations, oil industry members, as well as with the Iraqi government on any new legislation that was in development. And for that reason, legislation was delayed, so were some elections. And in fact, we've seen this process repeating itself now, even in today's Iraq. What about Afghanistan? I mean, we've heard some strange things about Karzai's family, and we're going to be speaking with Gareth Porter, who's also writing for Interpress Service these days. But just comment on the degree to which these types of stories are entering the consciousness of the Pakistani public through the Pakistani media.
Well, I think regarding the Iraqi question first, I think Patrick Cowan had put it best. He would say that all these agreements are not worth the paper that they are written on, because once the U.S. forces withdraw, the new government, whoever it is going to annul them. And in Afghanistan, it's a slightly different case because there hasn't been a strong government, for that matter, any government in more than 30 years now. So as a consequence, it is all very amorphous. So you have all these different factions jockeying for power, except that the Taliban today is far more sophisticated than they were more than 10 years back. So indeed, I mean, there are attempts, except Afghanistan in terms of material, it doesn't offer much material resources which the Western corporations might be interested in. At one point, there was this talk of a pipeline, except there are better routes for the pipeline because there is a proposal for running a pipeline through actually Iran. And that's where there is a big dispute inside the U.S. administration, because there are elements which want to accommodate Iran because of the economic benefits. And Iran is a potentially large market and also offers plenty of oil. It has oil and gas, whereas with Afghanistan, there is no such incentives for the U.S. to stay. So right now, in fact, another dynamic here is that the forces, the elements which are interested in at some point attacking Iran are precisely the ones who don't want a withdrawal from Afghanistan because they think that it's going to diminish the chances of future attack on Iran.
And those forces would include someone like John Bolton, the former U.S. ambassador to the U.N. We've seen actually something of a resurgent of that kind of rhetoric. They've been having meetings, should Israel attack Iran. Again, what's the climate in Pakistan, or what's the climate in general when it comes to Israel and the U.S. and the policies being advocated by what we might call the hard militant right, some call the conservatives in America?
Well, indeed, there is a cooperation between the aggressive militarists and the neoconservatives, and they're very much fronting for the neoconservatives, obviously, are sort of, they very much serve as a vanguard for the Israel lobby. And what is happening is that, as a consequence, if you speak to anyone in the region, they fear a sort of a neocolonialist attempt to dominate the region or tie it down through these types of puppet governments. So as a result, there's a great deal of suspicion. Any government that is seen as cooperating with the U.S., it doesn't boost its popularity. So same is true today of the Pakistani government. Since it is seen as too cozy with the U.S. government, it has a very low approval rating inside Pakistan. The most surprising thing was that recently there has been a surge in support for the military in Pakistan as opposed to the democratic government. And that is because the military recently put its foot down when there was that whole question of the Kerry-Lugar bill, which was supposed to give aid to Pakistan in return for, well, cooperation in the so-called war on terror.
You mentioned changing attitudes toward Musharraf as he had given orders for a mosque that was held by Taliban sympathizers. This goes back to 2007. The mosque stormed and then many dying and Musharraf being blamed.
Actually, what Musharraf was blamed for was not exactly the killing of the Taliban. It was for bringing on the retaliation. So what happened is that until then, the mainland of Pakistan was very much protected from any kind of blowback. Most of the Pakistani military operations were being carried out in the tribal regions, which are semi-autonomous. So what was happening was that very little of this was being noticed because Pakistani society was not paying any kind of price for the aggression in these regions. And it was aggression, all right, because Human Rights Watch had published several reports, and there were collective punishment and indiscriminate use of force. But what happened is that after that mosque incident, suddenly the mainland started being targeted by the militants. And when people realized that now they could be the potential targets of this blowback, so then they started blaming Musharraf, who until then was quite popular. And I mean, that is to say, popular among the elites. And the rest of the country mostly remained voiceless until there was this sort of a surge of dissent. Mainly, it was manifested through the lawyers' movement for the restoration of a chief justice who had been booted out by Musharraf at the time. So, and secondly, the media in Pakistan became very active. It's a very campaigning media, so it started really going after the dictatorship. And eventually, I think that it played a very significant role in bringing it down.
And we should mention, we're speaking with Idris Ahmad. He's a member of Spin Watch, but he's also focusing on propaganda, the role of lobbies, think tanks, and the war in Iraq. This for your PhD. Is that right, Idris?
That is correct.
And how far along are you with your studies?
Well, I'm nearly finished, and I think that my PhD is going to come out, my thesis is going to come out as a book next year. I think that most of these conflicts are, this appear to have the same provenance. I wouldn't say that, for example, Afghanistan and Iraq war started because of the same reasons, but at present, the same interests. For example, the Project for New American Century has recently been revived as the Foreign Policy Initiative. It's under a new name, and it's the same individuals, and they are the ones who are really pushing for the surge in Afghanistan.
So I guess it's now pretty well understood that the neoconservatives have been just as successful at impacting U.S. foreign policy under the Obama administration as under George W. Bush.
Indeed, they are. And they have also, the interesting thing about the way they operate is that they tend to be rather ecumenical when it comes to the political parties, because they have now established quite good relationships within the Democratic Party. So Center for American Progress is quite, has been holding joint events where you get many neoconservative speakers. So, and these are the people who are actually serving as the think tank for the Obama foreign policy. So Obama foreign policy at the moment is very much being determined by the same forces which were previously active during the Bush era. In fact, in the latter years of Bush, they had very much sort of declined. And that was one of the reasons why in the end, Bush had refused to, well, I won't say refused, but he was reluctant to engage Iran because he knew that already the U.S. had swallowed more than it could handle.
Barack Obama, who promised to use negotiations to solve problems during his candidacy.
Actually, what happened was that during the campaign, he, since the Iraq war was very unpopular, so he opposed that. But at the same time, in order to prove his credentials as being tough on defense, so he picked up Afghanistan as the good war. So right now, he is very much tied down by his own earlier promises. So in fact, if you remember, during the campaign, he was even criticized by McCain and Hillary Clinton at one point for saying that he was going to bomb Pakistan if he finds that Al-Qaeda is based there. So the way it has been going, there have been far more drone attacks so far under Obama's presidency than there had been under Bush. So far, it doesn't show that he is actually changing course at all, but sort of the reality is dawning on many people, and that is why what is happening is that some people are trying to think of some kind of a fallback position, and which includes negotiations with elements that they think that they can, or mainly it's a search for a face-saving device, because the realization is there that this war cannot be won.
U.S. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton was asked by a Pakistani woman at a town hall meeting event there if U.S. drone attacks are terrorism. She said, no, they're not. Her trip to Afghanistan appears to have caused some calamity there.
Her presence there became a lightning rod for a lot of this resentment that had been building for quite some time. And she also appeared for a discussion with the media. And it was, I would say, far livelier than anything that you would have seen in the U.S. mainstream media. She was challenged by all, there are especially two very popular journalists in Pakistan. One is Hamid Mir and another Sayed Talat Hussain. So both of them challenged her very strongly. And she was on the defensive for most of the period. And in the end, her responses afterwards were, then they were broadcast on television because she was adopting a very much neo-colonial type of position. And this has been a cause of great resentment, especially what has happened is that the military has, again, by refusing to compromise on, well, I wouldn't say refusing to compromise, but they were quite upset with the conditions that were attached to the aid package. And ultimately, they have gone into Waziristan with that. But nevertheless, Hillary Clinton was very strongly challenged. And I think that her presence did not do anything to boost American popularity at this time.
You're listening to Talk Nation Radio, and we're going to hear a clip now from Fox News and Greta Van Susteren.
The aid that was just voted for, just passed the United States, the Kerry Lugar bill, because there are a lot of strings attached to it, because Americans want to make sure that the money is spent like we intend to do it. The Pakistanians, on the other hand, think that we're trying to tie them up in knots, put lots of strings on it. And there are even words in the press referring to it as offensive that we have so many strings attached to this money.
You know, it's interesting. Fox News had a segment with Greta Van Susteren. She interviewed Hillary Clinton. The spin that Greta Van Susteren put on all of this was really sort of very subtle in this case. Idris, you'd be expert at understanding this, I'm sure. But it seemed to me she was implying that the Pakistanis don't understand U.S. policy and therefore they're rejecting our aid, which is offered in good faith. There was also the sense that, you know, they don't understand the war on terror very well and what the U.S. is doing. Let's just say she didn't necessarily use these words, but I will, for the people of Pakistan. Now, I know in Pakistan, this is not at all the understanding of what is happening. Again, this woman who challenged Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, saying to, this is your war, not ours.
Mm-hmm. Yes, this precise point that Pakistanis don't understand the provisions of this bill. So it was picked up by Talat Hussain, one of the journalists, and what he did was he said that you are insulting the intelligence of the Pakistani people by even suggesting this, because he says that we have gone through this bill and we are very familiar with its provisions, and it's putting conditions on this aid, and especially the resentment also stems from the fact that Pakistan has spent far more, both in terms of blood and treasure, on this war than the United States has across the border in Afghanistan. I mean, there has been a total expenditure of $35 billion. So right now, with so many conditionalities attached with this aid package, which is $1.5 billion, it was a cause of great resentment and anger in Pakistan. That's why for the past month or so, the media has been completely consumed by this question and debates on this whole bill and what it means for Pakistan's sovereignty.
Pakistan, where, of course, the former government of Zia once received countless U.S. dollars in aid that went directly to some of the key players today that are fighting U.S. forces. Just comment on that history and whether or not that is brought up in Pakistan. It's barely ever mentioned here in the United States.
Well, I mean, over here, nobody is oblivious to that history in Pakistan. But there is, although, a difference in the way it is portrayed in the U.S. generally. That is both on the progressive side and on the conservative side. Because in Pakistan, at the time, the anti-Soviet struggle was a very popular war. So that is one of the reasons why, during that war, even though there was a lot of funding that was being received from Arab countries and from the U.S. and, in fact, from several other European countries as well, and some say even Israel as well. Apparently, there were at one point Israelis were shipping weaponry, which was being directed via Egypt to Peshawar. So that war was, as a result, seen as a popular war. But what happened in Pakistan, the resentment, and in Afghanistan was over the fact that as soon as the war was finished and as soon as the Soviets withdrew, the U.S. completely abandoned the place. And at that point, there was a need for some kind of, one, reconstruction, secondly, the use of the political clout to get the different parties to come to the negotiating table, because what happened is that there was a total vacuum of power after the Soviet withdrawal. And as a result, all these different factions started fighting each other, and the civil war continued. And that gave birth to the Taliban, because the Taliban came and brought a very brutal, yet a system which offered some degree of stability, at least for the first few years.
And someone like Gulbuddin Hekmatyar, I mean, he was empowered by U.S. dollars through Zia. What would you say about the way Pakistanis or maybe Afghans view this particular individual and what he did after receiving all that U.S. aid? Billions, I understand.
Oh, well, he was, during the siege of Kabul, up to 50,000 people were killed, and he was principally responsible for that. The thing about him was that even at the time, he was, although he was willing to receive U.S. aid, but he wasn't willing to, at one point Reagan had called him over to, when there was that famous meeting when the Mujahideen commanders were described as freedom fighters or equivalent of the founding fathers. So he had refused to shake Reagan's hand. So he still remains that hardliner. And he is now, I think his network is based in the North Waziristan region, and he's very active there. But I think in Pakistan and in Afghanistan, well, the popularity of these factions is, at least of the Pashtun factions, is limited to mostly the south and southeastern side. In the north, mostly the Tajiks dominate, who are at present dominant in the U.S.-backed government. So there, obviously, their popularity is very low. So I can presume to know what the Afghani population think about them. But in Pakistan, there's a sort of a different viewpoint. In Pakistan, what is happening is that Gulbuddin is not so much in the news, but the Taliban faction, the Afghani Taliban, you know, they're not exactly unpopular, I would say, because they are seen as, this is the second time that they are standing up to another superpower, and then they have fought it very much to a standstill. So over there in Pakistan, it's seen as a liberation struggle. So the Afghani Taliban aren't exactly unpopular at present.
And Idris Ahmed, what about what you said earlier about new levels of support for Pakistan's military? Where does Gulbuddin Hekmatyar fit in, or can you talk about other leaders?
Well, that is the interesting thing here, that the Afghani Taliban and Gulbuddin Hekmatyar, they are not being targeted by the Pakistani military. They are seen in the future as potential assets for once the U.S. withdraws, because there is a fear that there is increasing Indian political influence inside Afghanistan. So the military is not targeting them. The military is only targeting South Waziristan and the Bajau region and all the other FATA agencies, where it's mostly the Pakistani Taliban who are based there. And the Pakistani Taliban, again, is a collective name that is given to various factions who are, in fact, even driven by various motivations. But as a result of the constant assault, so they have been unified. And then in 2007, they formed an umbrella group called the Tehreek-e-Taliban Pakistan, TTP. And these are the ones who are principally at war against the Pakistani military. And Pakistani military isn't touching the Afghan elements because, first of all, they don't attack. They don't carry out any attacks inside Pakistan. The understanding is this, that Pakistan gives them sort of sanctuary so that in the future, once the U.S. withdraws, so they are likely to become key players in post-withdrawal, post for Afghanistan. So as a result, Pakistani government is not tackling them.
Hillary Clinton described as, you know, going to Pakistan to now win hearts and minds, but she visited India first. What impact did that have?
Well, I don't think that that helps at all. In fact, there is also a lot of anger over the fact that the United States has been, you know, providing nuclear technology and advanced military equipment, and the Indian Air Force is shortly going to receive very advanced fighter bombers and fighters. So as a result, Pakistanis are naturally concerned, and even if the military goes to war at American behest at present, I won't say that there's any love lost between the military leadership and the United States. They will be doing it for tactical reasons, for strategic reasons, but I don't think that there's any sense in which the United States is seen as a genuine ally, especially at a time when India is being empowered at the expense of Pakistan. And another thing was that initially, Richard Holbrooke was supposed to be an envoy to Afghanistan, Pakistan, and India. But Indian lobby in the United States, which is getting pretty actually significant. As a matter of fact, it has been for quite some years. Back in 2002, Stephen Walt had written a book called Taming American Power, where he has a very interesting chapter on the Indian lobby. So the Indian lobby got Obama to drop India from Holbrooke's purview. So again, at that time as well, this whole AFPAC is this designation is itself seen as an insult inside Pakistan.
What do you make, though, of this international process? I mean, at one point we were discussing another arms race, another Cold War. How would you read the climate today in the Middle East and with all of these international pressures and financial questions that are at play?
This is the interesting part. Actually, the United States could financially gain far more by having friendlier relations with these countries. I mean, even in Pakistan, there was a time, especially in the 80s until the mid-90s, where generally the United States was quite popular among people, and the United States' main investment in Pakistan, besides the support that was given to the Afghan refugees as well as the fighters, was that there used to be a lot of cultural interaction. I mean, there used to be the American Cultural Center in every city, and there used to be libraries and investment in schools and those kinds of things. And as a result, the United States was quite popular. And over time, what has changed is that the more it has adopted a belligerent attitude, as a result of that, there are growing resentments. And as a result, the United States has been left with no other choice but to, I won't say it has been left with no other choice, but the United States has resorted to propping up very unpopular local strongmen or dictators or just local sort of tribal leaders. And as a result, it has been maintaining its power through the direct use of force or intimidation. But I don't think that it in any way benefits the U.S. Financially at present. I mean, it has certainly empowered, because of the Iraq War, the instability that it had caused. So it certainly added to the speculation on the oil market, and at one point the prices soared. But overall, the U.S. is a big loser in all of this. It's already being, its monopoly is already being challenged in Saudi Arabia. Saudi Arabia is even getting weapons from different places, and already it has opened its oil for bidding for the first time in 2002 by other countries other than the United States. Until then, the U.S. had a monopoly. And even in Iraq, even this puppet government is renewing all Saddam-era oil deals with China and with Russia. So I think that this track that the U.S. had followed since at least 2001 has utterly failed. And if it continues with it, I mean, it's a matter of like how long the inertia will carry on. And the problem, unfortunately, with these policies is that unless there is some kind of a major setback or disaster, these massive bureaucracies don't change course.
And yesterday we saw the U.S. stock market rising, but the dollar had fallen prior to that rise on Wall Street, and analysts were claiming that the drop in the U.S. dollar, the value of the dollar, signaled more trust in the markets. What do you make of the drop in the dollar? Does it have a relationship with the fact that Iraqi and Iranian oil may be freed up for these other markets, maybe not even trading in the dollar?
Well, yes, in the Middle East, recently there was a report by Robert Fisk that he has been told that several bankers from various countries in the Middle East and in Asia have gotten together recently to consider selling oil through a basket of currencies. And there is certainly a tendency to move away from the dollar. So various countries are opting out of making any trade in dollars or keeping dollar reserves, because the dollar's price, it has been quite some time that it has been going down, and they no longer feel that it's a safe currency.
Well, I want to turn finally to another part of the world and a report from Judge Goldstone, who has been critical about the Israeli Defense Force operation in Gaza last winter, Operation Cast Lead. And in the context of human rights, America has long celebrated this version of history where, you know, we ensure human rights and offer this global moral compass. Here now, though, we are seeing not only a lack of support for Judge Goldstone's report, but also a resolution being circulated in Congress that condemns it.
That is true. In fact, the most interesting thing about the Goldstone report was the reactions that it generated, because far from being too harsh on Israel, actually, it exonerated Israel of the main crime, which was the crime of aggression. Recently, Judge Goldstone was being interviewed on Al Jazeera, and he was asked about this. So he says that he took it for a given that Israel had a right to strike Gaza and or to retaliate. And he said that he was only investigating the crimes that happened afterwards. But in international law, there are two concepts. One is called just ad bellum, and one is just in bello. The question of just in bello arises only once the question of just ad bellum, that is, the justness of the war, is satisfied. And the justness can only be satisfied if the war is seen as unavoidable, that all diplomatic options had been exhausted, and which weren't. And I think there was a very good article on that in the London Review of Books. Sarah Roy also had a very good article on that, about how actually there were several options available for Israel. And most importantly, Israel could have ended the siege, and that if that had failed, so then, yes, maybe it could have a right, but until then, it didn't. So the reaction of the United States was obviously very strange. We do know that, I mean, in the United States, again, it becomes a question of, you know, there are powerful forces at work which are now being challenged by organizations such as J Street, and for that matter, even The Daily Show, which has recently opened up the debate to anti-Zionists. So I think that things are changing in that respect in the United States. Now, regarding the legacy of human rights, I think the discourse of human rights in the 90s was somehow tied to military intervention. And as a result, there was a very dangerous situation created where even the discussion of human rights was used very often to legitimize military intervention. So, for example, a war like the Kosovo War can be presented as somehow, you know, fought in defense of human rights. And more recently, there have been, even the Iraq War was justified by some as somehow being in the interest of human rights. So I don't think that this discourse fools anyone outside of Western Europe and the United States. But over here, yes, I mean, it has become very much the hegemonic idea that the United States wages war for human rights. And I think what has happened also is that repeatedly the legacy of Second World War is invoked, which was the good war, as everyone remembers. So it is in that similar vein. So hence all the invocations of 1939 and of appeasement and fighting fascism. So these key phrases are invoked again and again to justify new wars. Hence, every new enemy becomes a new Hitler, and everyone who refuses to confront becomes a new Chamberlain. So I think that that discourse itself, its use has been quite dangerous in recent years. But again, it is only in Western Europe and the United States that this is taken seriously. Outside, there is the clearest impression that even the people who have been tried in recent years, people like Milosevic or people convicted like the president of Sudan, they are not part of the West. So it is still that power relation here. So genocide can only be committed by people who are them, not us. So that whole thing still continues.
Idris Ahmed, thank you for joining us.
Oh, it was a pleasure.
Idris Ahmed, joining us from Glasgow, Scotland. He is a student about to publish his PhD thesis as a book. And you can find his story about Pakistan online at ipsnews.net and look for a longer version of the story at the start of November in Le Monde Diplomatique. For Talk Nation Radio, I'm Dory Smith. This program produced in Storrs, Connecticut. TalkNationRadio.org for transcripts, audio, and discussions. TalkNationRadio@gmail.com if you'd like to comment on this report.